You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Lewis left a successful career at Solomon Brothers during the roaring 80s to try his hand at writing. So perhaps it's no wonder that he's been drawn to stories about risk takers with peculiar visions who bet against the current wisdom and then win big. It was inevitable that his focus would lead him to the work of two Israeli psychologists, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who discovered and exposed the systematic errors that people make when they evaluate uncertain situations. They pretty much invented the field of behavioral economics and imagined the new analytic system of decision-making that Mr. Lewis described in Moneyball and The Big Short. His latest book, The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, is the story of Kahneman and Tversky's work and their partnership. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Lewis back to our show. Hello.
Thanks for having me back.
You say that you found the work terrifying on some levels.
Well, terrifying. It was terrifying on two levels. One is as material for me to grapple with, just because it was all so new to me, and I didn't have any kind of grounding in psychology or in the early days of Israel. So I was nervous about my capacity to handle the subject matter competently. But it's terrifying to think that your mind can play tricks on you, and that you can't, you know, they're cognitive illusions just as they're optical illusions.
But to some degree, you have been drawing upon their work on your books even before you knew who they were. So weren't you familiar with some of their thinking before you started this one?
I was familiar with what had come through behavioral economics into baseball, through Moneyball. Mm-hmm. The idea that there were systematic biases in the way baseball scouts evaluated baseball players, and that you could kind of classify these things, and that the Oakland A's had in Moneyball done so. I knew that. I didn't know where the work had come from. I had no idea that there had been these people called cognitive psychologists who'd done this work to explain why the biases existed.
Didn't their work also apply to the story you told in The Big Short?
In some ways.
The people who saw through what everybody, the conventional wisdom?
You can make the case that some of what went on in the financial crisis with people being that the people who, at least the case of Michael Burry, one of the people who were in the character, the guy played by Christian Bale in the movie.
Brilliantly, by the way.
Brilliantly, absolutely. That he, what he was doing was relying on data as opposed to what everybody was saying or the judgments of professionals. And he saw that the judgments of professionals were really off.
After we had Daniel Kahneman on this show to discuss his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, I thought it was possible I'd never made an untainted decision. Did you have a similar reaction?
He leaves you in a state of eternal doubt when you spend time with him. I mean, this is who he is. He's the embodiment of human doubt. And it comes out of his childhood experience, and it comes out of the predisposition of his mind. But he does... It's funny, but that some characters I've written about, when I leave them, I think, yes, I'm ready to write. I understand this. Whenever I left Danny, I felt it's going to take me forever to get my confidence level back up in myself sufficiently to put words on the page.
Especially as a writer, because part of what they discovered was that people had such a need to find meaning that they created a story to explain what happened.
Yes, we are. That it's one of the many kind of lessons of their work, that people need more certainty and understanding in the world that's possible. We live in an inherently uncertain world that our mind is always turning into a more certain one than it is. And the way we do it is by telling stories. We find patterns, then we find meaning in the patterns. And even after the fact, we find ourselves in situations we never would have predicted. And yet we then pretend to be able to explain them as if they were predictable.
Kahneman wrote about that when he worked for the Israeli army. Didn't instructors believe that in teaching pilots to fly, criticism was more effective than praise? Why did they believe that, and why did Kahneman think they were wrong?
This was one of their many little nuggets of insight. But Danny went and watched the flight instructors train Israeli fighter pilots. And what the instructors had observed is that whenever a fighter pilot made a really successful maneuver and they praised him, he responded by making a less successful one the next time. And whenever he made a kind of unsuccessful maneuver and they criticized him, he got better the next time. And they thought this meant that the criticism worked and the praise didn't. It was like praise was kind of counterproductive. And Danny's point was, what you're neglecting is essentially the statistics of the situation, that a pilot has a kind of mean level of performance. And when he did something that was especially great, he was bound to revert to his mean afterwards. It seemed, and just as if as he did something especially poorly, he was bound to get better.
Otherwise, we would see a basketball player start hitting 80-90% of his shots if the coach criticized the way he had been shooting that night. But great shooters, one night they shoot 60%, the next night they shoot 35%.
You know that there is, I mean, there are some shooters who are better than other shooters, but there is, you know, there's a statistical mean around which each player sort of operates. And the point that Danny was making is that life sends us these feedback, these false signals telling us that our praise is ineffective and our criticism is effective, when actually what you're just seeing is a statistical illusion. Think of it next time you're about to criticize your spouse.
Never do. Do you look at your work differently now about the connections you've put together in it?
You know, in the writing of The Undoing Project, Danny, their work made me even warier than I am of my ability to tell a story. That I just, you know, there are, it's not that all stories are false, but it's that's very seductive to tell a false story. And so it just made me warier. Like, warier of the patterns I see.
Well, didn't this actually work against Daniel Kahneman? Is it fair to say that the more he worked, the less certain he became of his own findings?
This was just generally true of him in his life. That the way he would put it,
he was always doubting himself?
Yes, he would put it more delicately. He'd say, from a very early age, I really enjoyed changing my mind. And people don't enjoy changing their minds. I enjoyed finding that something was wrong with the thought or idea I had, because then it was an opportunity to improve that thought or idea. I think, though, in fact, he was predisposed to just doubt himself and doubt everything around him. And it was a way of preserving some distance from his ideas. Having that MO, that way of going through life, it meant that any idea he had, he was never fully committed to. And so he didn't have to defend it. And he was completely, that was the thing. He didn't have to defend it. And I think that's at the center of it. He just doesn't want to fight, doesn't want to defend it.
I'm speaking with Michael Lewis, whose latest book is The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. Well, when Kahneman was on our show, I asked him if people could use his book to make better judgments. And he said he didn't believe in self-help books and he didn't believe people could learn to see their own limitations. In fact, he said the book was good for gossips, to see what other people can't see about themselves and gossip about.
That in itself is self-help advice. Don't read self-help books. So he still believes in advice. And he and Amos Tversky, I think, would both say that these tricks the mind plays on you, they're like optical illusions, in that even when someone points out to you that the puddle on the hot highway is not a puddle, it's a mirage, you still see it. And so in the same way, even when someone points out to you your error, you're still susceptible to it. What their work outside of the academy, when they're actually kind of advising people, shows is that actually you can correct for it, but you maybe not you yourself, but you can create an environment in which your errors are more likely to be spotted by others and corrected that way.
When did you first hear about Kahneman and Tversky? How long after you began writing about things that they had influenced?
What happened was in 2003, Moneyball came out, and it was reviewed by an economist named Dick Thaler and a lawyer named Cass Sunstein together. And in this review, they said, Mr. Lewis has written a really interesting story about baseball, but he doesn't seem to realize that the reason these baseball scouts are misjudging or misvaluing baseball players was described by these two Israeli psychologists many years ago in their work on human biases. And that was the first time I'd heard their names. And Kahneman, which is embarrassing, because Kahneman had just won the Nobel Prize in economics. So that was the first time I'd heard their names. And then it was a couple of years after that that I finally summoned the nerve to get in touch with Danny and go visit him.
Now, he won the Nobel Prize in economics, even though he's a psychologist.
It's funny that no one points this out, how odd that is, that a Nobel Prize in economics is being given to a psychologist who, by his own admission, knows very little economics. He kind of quickly taught himself some of it, but he
had to teach himself statistics, how to deal with statistics.
He did, that's true. But so the reason he's awarded the prize is the effect his psychological work had on the field of economics. But it is extraordinary. He's an interloper. And as many psychologists pointed out to me, it's sort of a testament to economists' superior ability to sell their field that there is a Nobel Prize in economics but not a Nobel Prize in psychology.
Was it the work of Kahneman and Tversky that led people to use numbers and algorithms rather than the advice of experts to make decisions in medicine, in the ballpark, or on the trading floor?
Their work gave huge energy to the momentum in that direction.
Billy Bean even know who they
yes,
were?
Yes, he did. He didn't. He didn't. His right. His statistical advisor did, and so they help explain why an algorithm will be superior in many cases to human intuition. So they give a kind of rationale for it. Danny, interestingly, before this whole revolution of using algorithms had started, back in the early 50s, Danny is a young man in the Israeli army, with the only person around in sight with training in psychology, had redesigned the army's evaluation system so they determined who was an officer and who wasn't, by removing the experts who made intuitive judgments about those matters and replacing them with an algorithm. So he did Moneyball for soldiers before I ever stumbled upon Moneyball.
But many of the teams that went on to implement the Moneyball type analysis then backed away from it, like the Red Sox, who finally won the World Series, but now say that they aren't relying as much on the numbers.
What they said, the owner, John Henry, said after a bad season that maybe we've been overly reliant on the numbers. Nobody's gone back to the old world where you didn't have advanced statistical analysis in the front office helping you make decisions. It's from front office to front office in baseball, it's a matter of degree, whether they're using whether the decisions are driven by pure statistical analysis or whether you've got some gut feeling of an expert making the call. But if you look at baseball, it's been overrun by this phenomenon. I mean, Theo Epstein at the Cubs is a disciple of Billy Bean.
I'm speaking with Michael Lewis, whose latest book is The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. It's published by Norton. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Michael Lewis, his latest book, The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. It is published by Norton. And you start the book with a chapter about the Houston Rockets. Was the analysis they created and applied to team selection a step beyond Moneyball?
Yes, but what people in baseball are doing right now is a step beyond Moneyball. The reason I opened the book the way I did is I wanted to show that even at the bleeding edge of this analytics movement, in sports, which is the bleeding edge of the analytics movement generally, that the Houston Rockets are kind of state of the art, where their general manager Daryl Morey really went in and tried to replace all the human intuition with analysis. Even there, they reached the limits of analytics, and they realized that they were never going to completely banish the human judgment, and so he had to kind of learn what it was that was screwing up the judgment in the first place. So it's like the problem that never goes away.
But it's often pointed out that the top draft picks may not make it as well as the guy in the second or third round. The probably the most successful quarterback in football right now. Tom Brady was not the first person selected the year that he was drafted.
It is amazing.
So people are making other kinds of judgments. Couldn't have been statistical.
No, those weren't statistical. Well, I mean, that people, the mistakes in the draft are a book unto themselves. But the evaluation of the amateur athletes is, it's always going to be an imperfect science, even with numbers, that you're never going to be able to identify exactly who's going to make it and who isn't. What the numbers do is they just kind of queer the odds in your favor a bit.
Did Kahneman and Tversky intend for their work to have economic applications? Did they have a vision of how it could be applied?
It depends on which one of them you asked.
These are two very different guys.
Very different guys. And I think that Danny would tell you that it wasn't until very, very, very late in the day that he woke up to the thought that, oh my God, we're about to influence this whole other field. And people who knew Amos said Amos had a plan all along, that he knew economists, he knew that at the bottom of economics was this rational actor model, the idea that people were consistent in their preferences and that they maximized their utility and all these assumptions that economists made. And he knew that his work with Danny exploded all this and that he was actually on a kind of on a mission to challenge economics.
Well, you didn't have an opportunity to speak to him. When did he die?
1996.
So,
at age 59.
So Kahneman was pretty much continuing the work. He came up with the Kahneman scale.
The Kahneman score.
Score.
Was what he assigned to Israeli soldiers back in the early 50s when he was deciding who should be an officer and who should be an ordinary.
But that can apply to anything, can't it?
Sure, you could apply. You could, any kind of selection process could use this thing. But Amos. They had different. From the very beginning, I think they had different ambitions about what they were doing, but it didn't really interfere with the relationship. I mean, the relationship was very private and intense, and so focused on the task at hand, kind of uncovering the way the human mind worked and truths about human nature, that it didn't matter. They had different ambitions for it,
even though they had very different kinds of personalities. Tversky, an extrovert, Kahneman, an introvert. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say.
And someone in the book describes Kahneman as being like Woody Allen without the humor. That's kind of hard.
Yeah, well, that's before that. You know, people said to me, it's interesting. People said who had known Danny from way back when. And I made five trips to Israel to kind of get to know them in their early incarnations. But people said, you know, you're going to have real trouble describing Danny as he was, because Danny, since he won the Nobel Prize, is like a different person. There's a lightness to him that didn't exist before. He was dark and brooding and removed and felt to people like he was kind of descended from some formal place, even people who thought they knew him well. And he was, but also at the same time, the richest mind, richest font of ideas that anybody ever encountered, the bottom of it all is doubt. He is he's an embodiment of doubt.
Whereas Tversky was
the embodiment of certainty,
but
sure of himself to an incredible degree.
But you described their relationship as a bromance.
It was a love affair without sex. They were the love of each other's lives. And on his deathbed, Amos said to Danny, I need to say to you that no one in my life has caused me as much pain as you have caused me. And Danny said that he was about to say the same thing back to Amos and bit his tongue. They both found, I think, a missing piece of themselves in the other. That's kind of what it felt like. And they both found interest in each other's thoughts that they understood each other better than they understood themselves.
And you describe Kahneman as a pessimist. Do you think that his experiences during World War II were an influence on his personality?
So he was he survived the Holocaust in France as a Jew, as a boy. His father did not, but he and his mother and his father and his sister were on the run and hiding in barns and chicken coops and all the rest. And it sounds like it was a fairly traumatic experience. But Danny being Danny, doesn't say the obvious thing. Danny, who is a psychologist, asserts that his childhood has nothing whatsoever to do with how he is. Now, I'll leave that to readers to decide whether that seems plausible. Mm. It doesn't really to me, but he insists. And I would say, or I guess I'd put it this way, that if you get people describing Danny as he is as a young man, and then tell them and then you're informed what his childhood experience was, they seem to fit together pretty well.
Later in the book, you discuss why a Jew might have had a hard time deciding to leave France in 1939. Is this something that Danny talked about? Because his work explains it.
His work does explain it. It's that, you know, they call it the availability heuristic. It's people responding to what comes to mind, to what's happened most recently. And his father took one look at the situation, saw Hitler, and said, "This isn't serious. That we had war with the Germans in the First World War, and we weren't threatened by them then, and we're not going to be threatened by them now." And people make this mistake over and over. They think that what happened is what will happen. And so it does explain it. All Danny would say about his parents' decision to remain in France rather than leave, and they had that open to them because they had family and assets and all the rest in Israel, and they didn't leave because his father was so sure. His mother was less sure, and it was a source of friction in the family once his father was proved wrong.
My guest is Michael Lewis. His latest book, The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. It is published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did you call it The Undoing Project?
Two reasons. The first was I found the phrase on a file in Amos's filing cabinets, and it contained his notes on the project he and Danny were working on when they broke up. And Danny had no idea that Amos was interested in it and was working on it. Danny thought that Amos had lost interest in his ideas. And the Undoing Project, Amos called it the Undoing Project because they were studying the human imagination and studying it by seeing the way people undid events that had happened to try to create some alternative reality. So a friend dies in a car accident. You imagine the ways that accident might not have happened. Your favorite sports team loses. You say, if only the field goal kicker hadn't missed the kicker at the end of the game. If only, how people fill in that statement, if only. They noticed that there were patterns in the way people did this, and they revealed things about the imagination. So it was their unfinished work, and I was able to write it up in such as it is. But I realized when I saw the phrase, it wasn't a bad description of their joint work, that they were busily undoing a view of human nature that had taken hold in social science and that people probably generally accepted of human beings as, even when they're in a cool state of mind, as perfectly rational.
Did you have to do this because Kahneman is constantly doubting himself? Wasn't it even difficult for him to complete his book that became so influential?
When I first met him, he was working on his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And every other time I'd go see him, he'd say, "Don't worry, I'm not going to publish this thing. It's going to ruin my reputation. It's just so bad, it's not worth it." And my role in his life for a period of time was just to buck him up because it was so good. I mean, it was just everything comes out of his mouth is interesting, just like everything came out of Amos's mouth was interesting. And it was crazy that he wouldn't publish it. So I did give him, I tried to give him hope and confidence in his own work while I was figuring out what my work was going to be.
One of the concepts that I find fascinating is the halo effect.
Yes, that if you have a generally positive response to someone, you overrate their virtues in other ways.
And this affects, if you meet somebody who's really charming or really good looking, you immediately assume they have sorts of other qualities.
Yeah, you attribute to them a higher IQ than they have.
And doesn't that apply to many of the judgments we make, getting back to sports teams, for example, or the military judgments that Daniel Kahneman got involved with?
That's not their work, but yes, that's work that came. I mean, the halo effect was coined by a psychologist in the 1920s, 19-teens even. But yes, it's interesting. I've seen actually general managers of sports teams have told me that things like, you know, one reason interviews are useless is that if you like the first answer you get from someone, you like the second answer more than you should. And if you don't like the first answer, you dislike the second answer more than you should. The overall global impressions we form of people, instant intuitive impressions, pollute our ability to judge them.
Let's talk a bit about Tversky. How did he become a psychologist? Wasn't his ambition to become a novelist?
When he was very young, he thought he might be a poet. And he befriended a woman who became Israel's most famous female poet, Dalia Ravakovich, who was in his class in high school growing up. I think he figured out pretty quickly that he didn't have the chops. And a psychologist pointed out to me, it's amazing how many psychologists there are who figured out they didn't have the chops as novelists or poets. It was another way into the human condition.
Because novelists, to some degree, are the better ones functioning as psychologists. Flaubert, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky.
Absolutely.
We go to them because they have insights into the human psyche.
Absolutely. And Danny, oddly, I think totally had the chops to be a great novelist, but he had taken upon himself, for some reason, he got in his head he had to be a scientist. Amos Tversky was so gifted with math, and what he was a logician. I mean, he had the mind of a logician, and the school system in Israel eventually picked up on that and channeled him into, it was going to channel him into physics or maybe economics. And why he becomes a psychologist is, I think, is pure accident, because his mind usually doesn't find its way into psychology. Usually they're more muddier minds in psychology, and his is so clear. And the reason, I think, is that when he applied to Hebrew University, it didn't have a it just started its psychology program, and they hadn't existed before then. There had been an attempt to create one back in the 30s and early 40s, but the people they hired had been wiped out in an ambush, an Arab ambush. They just wasn't. Danny had taught himself psychology. He didn't have anybody to teach him psychology. But when Amos applies, they announce, we're going to have this psychology department. And it was a bit like announcing in Alabama that for the first time we're going to have a football team. The people predisposed to study this. And the lines out Hebrew University and around the block were incredible to get into this department. It was the most competitive department to get to, and Amos was competitive. And so I think he went for it because everybody wanted to be in it.
But he had been a parachutist in the Israeli army, and he describes his first experience coming to the United States.
Yes, he took a boat to New York. And he flew from New York to Ann Arbor, or wherever you land in Michigan, to go to University of Michigan. And the person who told me this was in the seat next to him, said he was looking down at the ground as the plane's going down with some wonder. And he says, you know, I've never landed before. And it was because the Israeli army did not waste time with you, taking you up in the air as a paratrooper if you weren't going to jump. And you jumped the first time and you jumped the last, and you never landed in the plane.
We can't get to all of the things that he did, but let's cover, or the two of them, a few of the things that they looked into. How does memory play tricks on judgment? They did an experiment where one group of kids was asked to multiply 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, and another to multiply 1 times 2, et cetera, the numbers backward. Did the results come out even close?
Not even close. Radically, you're asked to make one. You look at you're not given time to actually noodle with it and make the calculation. You're asked to estimate what that product's going to be, and if the first number is 8, people were estimating the number to be 4 or 5 times higher than if the first number was 1, and that was an illustration of what they called anchoring, that the mind fixes on the initial value and it distorts the subsequent judgment. So another example of this, they gave people a wheel of fortune that had numbers 1 to 100 on it, and they have them spin the wheel and the number would come up. And then they'd ask them to estimate the percentage of countries in the United Nations that came from Africa. And the people who had a high number on the wheel of fortune estimated a much higher number than the people who had a low number. It was like, the way the mind plays tricks. It can be manipulated by a completely irrelevant piece of information introduced up front.
Didn't they turn Santayana's line about those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it on its head?
They did. They didn't put it that way. I did. Mm-hmm. But their point was the past exerts an undue influence on our assessment of what's going to happen in the future, especially what's memorable about the past. So what's vivid and memorable ends up, you know, a hurricane hits New Orleans and floods it. For the next 5 years, everybody's sure that a hurricane's going to hit New Orleans, when the likelihood is not any greater than it was before.
But this is also the power of anecdotal thinking as opposed to analytical thinking.
As opposed to statistical thinking. And that's what they were giving people problems when they were studying the way the Maya worked. They had a correct, sometimes they were word problems, but there was a correct statistical answer to them. And they were showing the ways in which people violated the got the answer wrong systematically.
When did their work start to get serious attention?
That's in academia. Right away, 1969, 1970, 1971. Outside of academia, they talked about publishing a popular book, and they never did it. But they published a summary of their early work in science, in the journal Science, in 1974. And that I've met so many people in other walks of life, in medicine, in law, who picked this up and said, "Oh my God. This explains why juries can be manipulated by lawyers, or why judges sentence the way they do, or why doctors misdiagnose patients." So that was where it really started to catch on.
But on the other hand, it's all ex post facto, isn't it? As Kahneman said on my show, you can't use this to make decisions in your everyday life.
You can use it to know the drift of your
I don't
own
have
mind.
Any algorithms to explain whether I should go here or there.
There's a lot of truth to that, but you can create an environment which the decision is likely your mistakes are likely to be checked by others.
Are there specific ways that researching their work and understanding it has changed the way you make decisions?
Yes. In the broadest, vaguest way, these two characters are such powerful voices in my head now. I find myself thinking whenever I'm making a big, what would they say? You know, how would Danny Amos respond to this? I evaluate the world through their, it's such a gripping, clear lens. I'm warier than I was before, and that's saying something of my judgment. Mm. That if I have an instant sense of something, I stop myself and ask why.
This means it's going to take a lot longer for you to write your next book.
Probably. Maybe it will be better for it.
But it also means that, like Daniel Kahneman, you just keep on questioning and then you probably wind up with something really good.
You dig. So this is what one of his students said to me. He said, the key to Danny's personality, his character, is doubt. It causes him to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and that's why he gets places no one else gets to.
Michael Lewis's latest book, The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, is published by Norton. It's always a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.